For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got a collection of favourites from the archives. Robert Kirkwood blasts off with Colonel Chris Hadfield.
The real key to trying to grow up and trying to be somebody is to figure out how to be brave.
Judy Dench talks about her love of audiobooks.
And it's so glorious, a talking book on a long journey. I mean, what could be better?
Michael Palin on forgetting his lines on stage.
I took pride in the fact that I always got it right, all the time. On this particular night, it was coming up and I thought, hey, what do I say now? Where's this going?
Adjoa Ando on her life as a voice actress.
You have three female characters not talking about blokes, which is bliss.
And Anthony Horowitz shares the books of his life. That's all coming up in today's Read On.
Colonel Chris Hadfield had spent decades training as an astronaut and now has logged nearly 4,000 hours in space. During this time, he's broken into a space station with a Swiss Army knife, disposed of a live snake while piloting a plane, been temporarily blinded while clinging to the exterior of an orbiting spacecraft, and became a YouTube sensation with his performance of David Bowie's Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on.
In his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, Chris Hadfield takes readers deep into his years of training and space exploration to show how to make the impossible possible.
We didn't have a television set, but our neighbors did. And very late, on the evening of July 20th, 1969, we traipsed across the clearing between our cottages and jammed ourselves into their living room along with just about everybody else on the island. Dave and I perched on the back of a sofa and craned our necks to see the screen. Slowly, methodically, a man descended the leg of a spaceship and carefully stepped onto the surface of the moon. The image was grainy, but I knew exactly what we were seeing. The impossible made possible.
Chris Hadfield reading from his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. But he's on a new mission with his latest children's book, The Darkest Dark, to encourage children all over the world and of any ability to reach for the stars. He joined me on the line and first of all told me about the book.
One of the problems that all of us face, I think, is how do you deal with risk and danger and fear in your life? And I think it's especially true when you're younger because you haven't developed so many of the skills you need. And so everything is a little bit fear-inducing. And if you don't know what to be afraid of, then everything makes you fearful. And I think one of the most common fears when we're little is fear of the dark. It's sort of a natural, evolved fear. And what I wanted to try and emphasize to young people is that it's okay to be afraid. But the real key to trying to grow up and trying to be somebody is to figure out how to be brave, even though acknowledging that you're going to continue to be afraid. And of course, there's a difference between danger and fear. And I've spoken to adults on it on many different times, TED Talks and things. But the real purpose of this book, The Darkest Dark, was to talk about fear for young ones and how to find your inner bravery to do the things that you're dreaming of.
What sort of influences came from your own life?
I grew up out on a farm. We were growing corn and in a big old farmhouse in Canada, a farmhouse built in the 1840s, which for Canada is very old. And as a result, it's a big old creaky house with drafts and noises and barns. And to be a little kid in an environment like that is pretty daunting. A lot of darkness. It's not like living in a place with streetlights and modern conveniences. And so I remember very distinctly being right at the edge of my ability to function, to go out to the barns at night to feed the horses or to laying in my bed and listening and imagining all the things that were happening in the darkness. And yet, I went on to do spacewalks to fly a spaceship into the ultimate darkness that exists, which is leaving the Earth and entering into the infinite blackness of outer space itself. And somewhere along the way, I realized the beauty of and the depth and the palpable tangibility of the darkness, but also the fact that that your dreams and hopes often occur while it's dark, and then you try and put them into practice while it's light. And so I thought it would be, after talking with my wife and working with folks, I just thought that would be a lovely topic for this book. And we found two fellows to make the imagery, and then I wrote a song about it, and between the whole group, I'm very happy with the result. And watching the result now with the children and hearing the delight in their voices and helping them potentially not be afraid, to me that's a wonderful position to be in.
And you read the audio version?
I did. I recorded an audio version of my first book, Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and also of this book. There's an audio version available as well. To me, it's really important, and all of the stuff that I put on social media, all of the YouTube videos that we've made as well, have closed captioning on them, because of course it's important to me to try and have as many people be able to understand and hear and see and have access to the ideas of space travel that I possibly can.
The room erupted in amazement. The adults shook hands, the kids yelped and whooped, and somehow we felt as if we were up there with Neil Armstrong, changing the world. Later, walking back to our cottage, I looked up at the moon. It was no longer a distant, unknowable orb, but a place where people walked and talked and worked and even slept. At that moment, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I was going to follow in the footsteps so boldly imprinted just moments before, roaring around in a rocket, exploring space, pushing the boundaries of knowledge and human capability. I knew with absolute clarity that I wanted to be an astronaut.
What sort of books did you read when you were growing up, and have they had any influence?
I read fanciful books, of course, science fiction and adventure books, Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs and Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury and all of those. And they, to me, they were so different than the actual life I was living, so much wider and wilder and unfettered. And I think it really helped me to dream. It helped me to imagine myself doing things that otherwise I probably never could have given myself permission to picture. And amazingly enough, a lot of those things that those early science fiction authors predicted, or I don't know if they predicted them, but they imagined anyway, have since become reality. And to me, that's just a delight. And the fact that I've been able to be part of that transition from wild childhood fantasy and imagining right through to actually walking in space and commanding a spaceship.
The Jules Verne book, From the Earth to the Moon, where they just fire a projectile onto the moon's surface, that would have put me off becoming an astronaut.
I wasn't really inspired by that one. You know, the one that really inspired me by Jules Verne was Mysterious Island, because it was the real adventure tale of exploration, but also of human ingenuity, of relying on our own skill, our own learned capabilities, our own ability to work together as a team to then prevail and accomplish and understand and succeed in a place that otherwise would have never allowed us to do any of those things. And I think even I read that book quite young and recently reread it, and the protagonist, who's Cyrus Harding or Cyrus Smith, depending on which translation version you read, to me is sort of the prototype for who I wanted to become. And I recently discovered that Jules Verne even gave him a mustache, which may have been very formative for me in my own choices of what I how much of my face I shave.
Did you take books with you up to the ISS?
Most of the books on the ISS, of course, are electronic, just because we try and save weight. But there are advantages to having a book in hand. They're just, you know, you can, it's just kind of a nice palpable thing and a link with home. So there are a few printed books on board, but most of the books are electronic, either spoken books where the author has read them so that you can listen to them while you're working on, or exercising or something, or just digital books you can read.
There seems something so relaxing about just being weightless and reading a book.
Yeah, it's just there's so little time. Really, the only time I had to read up there was while I was exercising, and we have to exercise 2 hours a day, or just before I went to sleep at night. I would read just to give my brain a chance to sort of settle into a pattern that would let me sleep. But the rest of the time, you're very much oversubscribed for work, so it's not a place you can just steal time and go read.
Now, The Darkest Dark is out now. Where can people get the book?
Oh, in any of the bookstores. It's also available online. Probably the easiest is if you go to just my own website, chrishadfield.ca, CA for Canada, chrishadfield.ca, and it will list all of the places through all of the online sellers, but also in bookstores all over the place, in all of its various versions. And it's already, I think, in 6 countries or 6 languages. And multiple countries and spreading. So hopefully as widely available as we can make it.
Colonel Chris Hadfield, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks to Robert and to Colonel Chris Hadfield.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. To join, telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk. RNIB is a membership organisation. To join, visit rnib.org.uk/membership.
Join RNIB Connect and become part of a wider and stronger community led by blind and partially sighted people. Membership is free and it's the best way to keep in touch with things that are of interest and help to you. You'll receive Connect magazine, our membership publication, in your chosen format, as well as having the chance to be amongst thousands of like-minded, blind and partially sighted people, friends, families and supporters. You'll also be able to take part in and organise social activities in your area, campaign for change and improve the lives of people with little or no sight, and get help from our dedicated RNIB Connect support team. It couldn't be easier to join RNIB Connect. Simply complete the online form at rnib.org.uk or join over the phone by calling 0303 1234 555.
Dame Judi Dench's first professional debut was as Ophelia in the Old Vic's 1957 production of Hamlet. And over the next 20 years, she established herself as one of the greatest actresses of the post-war period, taking on all of Shakespeare's leading female roles from Cleopatra to Lady Macbeth. Her first starring role in film was as Queen Victoria in Mrs. Brown, a role she reprised in Victoria and Abdul. And of course, she recently played M in 7 James Bond films. And as Red Sail found out, it appears she has some royal fans.
Now, I hear you're here by royal invitation.
I am. I am here. Prince of Wales asked me to come up to Dumfries House and do the opening of the book fair, and I said absolutely no second bidding required. I'm thrilled. I love Scotland, love it. And so very easy for me to say yes.
And you're no stranger to playing royal parts both on stage and on the big screen. When you're playing a character like Queen Victoria, do you do much background research reading?
I did a huge amount of background on Mrs. Brown. Huge amount. So, I mean, I and a whole lot of other people didn't know, really, about her friendship with Abdul. It was only very recently that all the letters and things were found, written by her in Urdu, and so nobody realised what they were. And so it was wonderful, having done Mrs. Brown, to kind of, you know, think of those few years, and then suddenly she had, you know, the delight of having this lovely young man who taught her things, who she was able to talk to, who taught her to write in Urdu, who had a wonderful sense of humour and, you know, I'm sure brought extra years to her life.
Are you a very keen reader yourself?
No, I can't read at all. I can't read at all now because of my eyesight.
So macular degeneration has taken away all ability to read text, has it?
Yes, I get taught scripts and things by friends, and you know, you adjust so quickly to something like that, just adjust to it, and fortunately it doesn't happen overnight, but it happens during a length of time, and then you somehow adjust to that.
I know you've narrated a lot of books, audio books.
Not many. I'm no good at it. I tell you, my husband, Michael Williams, was wonderful at it. And my daughter, Finty Williams, she's won 7 awards. She's simply wonderful at audio books.
And she's an RNIB narrator. I know The Tale of Emily Windsnap is actually one of my daughter's favourite books.
Oh, I'm very glad, and I'll tell Finty. She'll be very glad, too.
So do you listen to audiobooks yourself much nowadays?
No, but I'm going to start and do that. I just think I've got such a lot to catch up on. You know, I miss the whole thing, reading, and I used to paint a great deal, and I gave up painting. And then it was a friend of mine who said, you know, really, you know, you don't paint for anybody else, you paint for yourself. So I'll paint what I think I can see, and that doesn't matter. It's not, you know, for a gal. You know, everyone gets frightened and thinks somehow it's going to be on display. It's not going to be on display at all. It's just going to be for my own pleasure. So every Tuesday I go and paint. It's lovely.
And, of course, the advantage of listening to a talking book is that you can paint as well because your hands are free.
And it's so glorious, a talking book on a long journey. I mean, what could be better? If you have a long journey to do and you have a story to be told, I think it's irresistible.
Do you have a wish list that you'll be going to the RNIB Talking Books Library with?
My wish list is almost everything that's come out in the last 10 years. I'm going to be kept busy.
And obviously you're still acting as well. I heard you say on the news last night that you wouldn't stop acting until you started tripping over the furniture. Have you got...
Done that. Tripped over the furniture. Yes, I'm filming at the moment with Ken Branagh, and then I'm going to do a film with Eddie Izzard in the summer, and then I think I'm going to do another one in the autumn.
It sounds like you're keeping extraordinarily busy, and you have signed hundreds of books this morning, by the looks of it.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Keeping literacy going in the UK.
I hope so.
Well, Dame Judi Dench, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Adjua Ando on a white giraffe. But first... A huge supporter of RNIB and the Talking Book Service is Michael Palin.
Day 1, 25th of September, 1988. I leave the Reform Club, Pall Mall, London, 115 years, 356 days, 10 3/4 hours after Phileas Fogg. It's a wet, stuffy morning. I've had 3.5 hours sleep, and the only thing I envy Phileas is that he's fictional.
A clip from 80 Days Around the World, which kicked off Michael Palin's unexpected second career. And it's also the starting point for his book, Travelling to Work, a third volume of diaries, which also chronicles the success of the film A Fish Called Wanda, the birth of travel shows Pole to Pole and Full Circle, and much, much more. I spoke to Michael Palin in the King's Theatre in Edinburgh just before his one-man show and asked him if, after all these years, he still got nervous.
Yeah, I always get nervous. I mean, you've got to, really. I think the times when I'm... think I'm not nervous are always the worst because I go into it and I just feel nice and relaxed. I remember the last of the Monty Python shows at the O2 It was, despite a lot of pressure, because it was being filmed all over the world, sent out to cinemas, it was lovely. I was really nice and relaxed, really, really enjoying it. And there's one particular rather complicated line I had to do, and I took pride in the fact that I always got it right, all the time. On this particular night, it was coming up, and I thought, hey, what do I say now? Where's this going? And I made something up to patch my way through it. But that was a wake-up call. I said, come on, Payne, get nervous. Don't be smug. And it is a fact that I think that's just energy coming into your body, the old adrenaline working. I've come to terms with it.
What was the line?
It was in the Protestant sketch, because we are, you know, Protestants who successfully challenged the supreme power of the papacy in the early 16th century. We can wear little rubber things on the end of those, you know, one of these, yeah, to prevent issue, yes.
Yeah. That was quite nice, reading Travelling to Work, when you were actually nervous about doing your interviews at the start.
Well, I was a comedian, I'd done acting, I could do comedy and all that sort of thing. But this was something I wasn't quite sure what they required me to be as a traveller. Mm. Yeah, was I to be pretending to be Phileas Fogg? So was I acting? Or was I just me, Michael Palin? In which case, what on earth would I talk about that would be of any interest to anybody? Or was I going to be a presenter, reporter with a microphone, asking people questions about their country and all that? And we hadn't worked this out. Mm. And so at the beginning, I suddenly became aware that I really wasn't sure if I could, what I could deliver. Mm-hmm. And when I did interviews to start with, we tended to do quite set-up interviews, you know, and they weren't always with people I particularly wanted to talk to. And so we'd go through it, and it'd actually be quite dull, because I wasn't really terribly interested, to be honest. What happened after the third of the third episode, when we were on a dhow going across from Dubai to Bombay, we were with 18 Gujarati fishermen, Indian guys, just on a dhow. They didn't know any English, and we depended absolutely on their expertise and their navigation to get us from place to place. And we all slept on deck together. They cooked us food, and we suddenly sort of I got little relationships forged with these guys who I'd never normally speak to at all. And it, by the time we finished that journey, I realised the best thing was just to be as natural as possible, to show what I could do, which was had a genuinely inquiring, inquisitive nature, and make some of the interviews just encounters. You didn't have to talk to the Prime Minister, you don't have to talk to the head of this or that, just the people you meet along the way, make contact, have encounters, and you learn a lot about, different people in different ways of life. So then I relaxed and I said, I'm just going to be me, curious me, going around the world. And it kind of worked out.
And yet it's reduced to a footnote in the book, I noticed.
A lot has been said about Around the World in 80 Days, and I've written a book based on all my experiences. That was published back in 1989. So I didn't want to go over that ground yet again in the diaries. So in the diaries, you see, I've got some of the private diaries that I kept, personal diaries that have never been seen before, and a few of those, but they don't cover much of the journey. And then it really starts when I come back and you get back to life, and suddenly there's lots going on. And this great journey, which you've just done, is it's one of three or four other projects. I have to start writing the book straight away. And of course, what I have to remember is that I wasn't expecting to do any more travel series at all. This was entirely a one-off. I didn't even know how it was going to work. So I had to make sure that I had other balls in the air, other things to go back to. So that's perhaps why it seems less enormous and significant.
Was there a resistance to edit with the benefit of hindsight?
Yeah, I mean, I had to edit. It was a colossal amount. I mean, I think it's about 20% of the diary there. What I tried to do was not to edit, within lines here and there, not to change anything that I'd written at the time. I'd take out a chunk here and there, say, family holidays. We took out all family holidays, which I described at some length, and that helped. But what I try and do is keep each particular entry pertinent to what I was, to the pattern of the diary, because I think the diary is, although it was written just on those days, there is a kind of story in the sense there's my work, there's my family, there's, you know, all the various other elements of your life have to be there, your friends, how are you getting on with them, the pythons, whether we still see each other. So I wanted to be sure when I edited that I kept that balance of all the things that were going on in my life. But I don't change any of the lines from what they were when they were written on the day. That's very important.
Now, is that a pleasant stroll down memory lane, or is it cringeworthy reading back?
Oh, it's a bit cringeworthy sometimes. You know, you realise that you made wrong decisions or you made wrong judgments. But that's the life. It sort of brings you up, reminds you of why things went wrong and things you've done wrong. But that's the way it is. And what it does do, it's quite reassuring because it makes you aware that things don't always take a smooth course. Mm-hmm. You're very much making a very snap judgment on something and it may be the wrong one the next day. Mm-hmm. But here, you know, in the diaries, the wrong judgment is there for you to see and learn from. It's not been expunged. It's not meant, you know, it's not meant to have taken out to show that everything worked marvellously. And that's very reassuring because my life is still like that nowadays. I'm still sort of getting things wrong. And, you know, there's no magic formula. You can't say, I want my career to be this or that. And so looking back, actually, it reassures me rather more than, it does embarrass me every now and then.
Is Brazil going to be the last journey or are there other ones planned?
I'm pretty certain that I won't do any more long journeys. Partly because I think we've done a lot of them. I've seen a lot of the world. And I think the formula is now sort of copied by lots of other different people. And the idea of people in all walks of life, or, you know, from all areas of writing or academia or television doing journeys around the world is now commonplace. So there are lots of people going around the world. There's people like Simon Reeve. They're doing amazingly good stuff, and I think that the time has come for me to concentrate on a different way of traveling, which may well be just single 60 minute documentaries, rather like some of the art shows that I've done for BBC Two. And then you're not away for so long, and also, I mean, doing a journey and supplying the book that goes with it and doing the publicity. It's like a 2-year job. And I'm now 71 and I've got grandsons and all that. I don't really want to be stuck on one project. I want to be able to do lots of different things, which I am at the moment, which is very nice.
Why do you support RNIB and have done for many years?
Well, I think that, you know, because you can't see, because you have problems with sight, you shouldn't be unable to read the works, all the books that are out there, and certainly the books that I've written. In fact, I love making the tapes because I think people who are unsighted they take in more. I'm sure that they're actually listening more carefully to what you're saying. And that's great for a writer, and I think it's a great responsibility. But I think you've really got to make your writing available to everybody. There should be nobody who, just because of the way they are, aren't able to sort of access what you've said. But I do think there's a very positive thing that the blind sort of actually listen. And I've had all sorts of sort of feedback from that, saying, you know, it's very, they listen to it very carefully. And that's great.
Conscious of asking easy questions, not probing enough, being almost too respectful. Always, after the interview, I think of the one question I should have asked. The silence outside on the straight, empty avenues is quite a shock after Cairo. So is the hot water, even though it's only a shower. No bath since Venice. The room is quite characterless and depressing, as is Suez. Can't wait to get on a boat tomorrow and get moving.
Michael Palin's Travelling to Work, available now in audio. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Michael Palin. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
Allow me to introduce you. Roland began, then interrupted himself. No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Woland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?"
"Trousers don't suit cats, Messiah," replied the cat with great dignity.
"Sit down and stop all this hot air."
"Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it, but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Martian Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself."
"Check," said Woland.
"Check it is," rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette.
"So," Woland turned to Margarita, "let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azazielo and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hela. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band."
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master Margarita together and that they both loved it. But it was going to be her birthday the following week. And he was taking her down to Dorset, and at a certain time on her birthday they were going to be walking along a beach there. And he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in the Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that just because you've recorded a book. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
Adjua Ando is a star of stage, screen, radio and audiobooks. Listeners may know her best as the voice of the number one ladies detective agency. I caught up with Adjua Ando as she took a break from recording at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'll start off with the number one ladies detective series. Mm-hmm. They sound like great fun to record.
What's interesting about them is they give you a sort of a gentle snapshot into one perspective on Africa. They're gentle books. I think gentle is the word that comes to mind when I think about them. You know, they talk about difficult subjects in a gentle way, and they use Africa as a great backdrop for gentle detective stories with fun characters that you sort of come to know and love as the series develops. And what's great about them is you go from the beginnings of the detective agency, what caused Ma Ramotswe to have the detective agency in the first place, and then the lives of the people who join her. So you know, Ma Makutsi, and then Ma Ramotswe's Mr. Jelbi Matekone, her husband, who has the garage next door, and Futi Radifuti, who marries Ma Makutsi. So who owns a furniture shop. So you start to get this. He starts the building blocks of the world, Alexander McCall Smith, and then things come in and out of the world. And the actual detection is only part of the joy of the stories. You just see people develop and grow and have kids and grow up and fall in and out of relationships and friendships and have a sense of the world that they inhabit on a day-to-day basis as well.
Rather like a soap opera.
Yes, you could say they're sort of a gentle extended soap on the page or, you know, in the audio. Yeah.
I know you've also narrated several more hard-hitting books to do with Africa and the history of slavery. Have any of those really stuck in your mind when you've read them?
Well, I've done a whole heap of, I mean, I must have done over 100, in the hundreds now, of audio books. And given that I've got a Ghanaian father and an English mother, a selection of them have been set in Africa, which I love. There's a writer called Aminata Fauna who wrote a book called The Devil Who Danced on the Water, and another book called Ancestor Stones, which are about growing up in Sierra Leone with her father as the finance minister in the first post-independent government. I love her. Her mother was Scottish, her father Sierra Leone. Ancestor Stones is about the lives of four of her aunts. And she does it in a historic way. So she goes back to the founding of the village that her family grew up in. So you get a history of the tribes and the culture of Sierra Leone. But you get these fabulous stories about women who fall in love, women who never marry, women who deal with mental health issues. They are in Sierra Leone. Some of them travel to England. Some of them become business women and travel all over the world. You hear all sorts of things. So you get a history of her family through these four women's stories, and you get a history of the country as well. So it's sort of rather brilliant. And then The Devil Who Danced on Water is about what it was like being a little girl in this country as her father became the finance minister with her Scottish mother, and then the civil war that happens in the country and the fear. And her father is, if it's not a spoiler alert, he's a historical figure. Then her father is hung. So it's the book is the first 10 years of her life and the last 10 years of his and what happens to them. It's the terrifically moving writing. So those aren't fictional, they're factual books, but really wonderful. So she's a great favourite. Then you get slavery, so you get Africa from another perspective when you look at some of the works that are set in America. Interestingly, I'm here at the moment. We've bumped into each other because I'm recording some science fiction stuff here. There's a fantastic writer called Octavia E. Butler. She was writing science fiction from the 50s onwards. Black woman, extraordinary woman. And I suppose her most popular book is a book called Kindred, which came out in the 70s, which I haven't actually recorded. But it's I'd love to record it. Maybe I'm putting a little pitch. I'll record Octavia E. Butler's Kindred, anybody. But that tells the story of a woman who, through a sort of time warp in the fabric of, I don't know, whatever it is that we live in, gets flung back into slavery as a black woman. And she doesn't know when it's going to happen. So she can be sitting at her desk writing in America, and suddenly she's sucked back through this time vortex and she's a slave. And when she's a slave, that experience can last for months. And she's experiencing slavery like somebody from our era would experience it, with all the horror and the misunderstanding about what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do and all of that sort of stuff. And then she gets flung back into her contemporary life, and then it goes backwards and forwards. And that book gave me a real chilling sense of what it is like to suddenly have no power or no agency or control over what happens to you. So there's a real range of work out there.
I first came across you when I was reading one of the Anne Leckie books.
Ah, yes.
Another sci-fi writer.
The great Anne Leckie.
And I believe you've read all her books to date.
I think
you?
I have, yes.
The Imperial Raj series.
Yep, yep. What's so great about science fiction work when it's extremely well written and thought through is it becomes a space in which you can talk about our society but not have to be limited by the limits of our society. You can talk about what's possible. You can talk about morality. You can go to extraordinary worlds and have these amazing vistas and senses of what the parameters are that are just free of the limits of our parameters. There's another writer called Alistair Reynolds who is also extraordinary at doing that, and he's a physicist. And I remember reading one of his books where one scene, there is a woman whose family heritage is East Africa, who were very close with elephants, and East Africa had become the place where all space study was happening. She is living on a new planet that humans have gone to try to repopulate. And she gets dragged off into intergalactic AI wars. So she's talking to an artificial intelligence, which is manifest as an 8-year-old Chinese girl, but actually is an artificial intelligence that goes right across the universe. And they're talking to another intelligence, a massive female whale. So you've got this East African woman, the small Chinese girl who is really an AI, and a massive talking female whale, all having a conversation about science and what is going to happen to all the different planets. It's just these moments of bliss. And what you also have is you have three female characters not talking about blokes, which is bliss.
I was going to ask you, when you are clearly so busy, you've been a lead actor at the National, the RSC, you've had long-running parts in Casualty, EastEnders, Doctor Who, where you were Martha's mum,
mm-hmm.
MI High, which was my children's favourite programme for
hooray.
A very long time. You are the boss.
I am, yes.
I was going to ask you why you kept coming back to talking books, and I think you've actually answered the question already. You clearly love it.
I do. I love well-written material, and it doesn't really matter what medium. My father, as I say, is from Ghana, and I you know, he listened to the World Service, and I grew up listening to radio. I love storytelling. I love listening to stories. But also, specifically to the RNIB, I had an uncle who was a great sportsman. He played rugby for England in the 70s, and a very physical person who got cancer. And one of the ways it manifest was that he had a tumour that pressed onto his optical nerves and he went blind. So he would listen to a lot of talking books. He would listen to a lot of storytelling. He would make me read things to him. And I really, really began to value the work in that way. Just that opening out of the storytelling, you know, the opening out of the literature. So I like listening to stories and I enjoy sharing that with other people. So, you know, I have a particular fondness for the work that RNIB does in that way. Literature should be accessible to everybody. And if I can join in with that, then I'm very happy to. Also, I'm gainfully employed doing something I love. What's not to like about that?
Indeed. And you have a beautiful voice that brings an awful lot of pleasure to those of us who can't actually read the physical copies of books anymore. I'm thoroughly looking forward to a weekend of sitting down and reading the White Giraffe series, because I'm interviewing its author, Lauren St. John.
Oh, yes, the White Giraffe series.
So,
they were great. Those books were great. They were so great. She has a real skill at, you know, books that are ostensibly aimed at, I don't know, young teen readers, perhaps. But they just work brilliantly for everybody. I found them incredibly moving and engaging, those stories. Great central characters, plucky teenagers having to cope with really difficult and sad and frightening things in their life and finding ways to navigate their way through the world. So, you know, stories that are very exciting but also full of great encouragement.
I do think that the young adult sector of publishing is probably the most exciting at the moment. Gone are the days where we protect children from the fact that people do die and people can be unfair and do get bullied. And yet there's that magical realism that operates in a teenage mind that just flows off the page. It's exciting.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, what's communicating? What's literature? What's storytelling for? I think it's what I call it's a heart-to-heart resonance. It's about being able to share experiences. It's about sharing experiences that may not be familiar in the detail of them. But, you know, we all go through the same things in different circumstances and in different ways. And to be able to explore how one copes with different situations and how one triumphs or fails within them and comes to some sort of way of being able to move forward is really important. And that's what's so exciting about stories. You can go anywhere you like with them, really, and that's great. I think that way of not shielding youngsters from trickiness is just honest, because it's not like they're not experiencing it. Let them read about it, hear about it, share other people's experiences and see and reflect on how they're managing their own.
Yeah, and develop their empathy.
Absolutely. Empathy, coping skills, permission to know it's all right to feel terrible about something and to feel like a failure or a disaster area, and to know that that's not the end of your life.
It's strange. You hear stories about ancillaries, and it seems like the most awful thing, the most viscerally appalling thing the Ratchai have done. To invade and take, what, half the adult population? And turn them into walking corpses, slave to your ships, AIs? Turned against their own people? If you'd asked me before you annexed us, I'd have said it was a fate worse than death. She turned to me. Is it? None of my bodies is dead, Divine, I said. And your estimate of the typical percentage of annexed populations who were made into ancillaries is excessive. You used to horrify me, said the head priest to me. The very thought of you near was terrifying. Your dead faces, those expressionless voices. But today, I am more horrified at the thought of a unit of living human beings who serve voluntarily, because I don't think I could trust them.
My guest, Adjoa Ando, reading Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, which is TB21614. My thanks to Adjoa Ando, and you can find a full list of the books that she has narrated by going to the RNIB Library website at rniblibrary.com. Do you have a favourite narrator? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. That's readonair, all one word, @rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And now it's time for Books of Your Life, this week with Anthony Horowitz. I caught up with him at the Boswell Book Festival and started by asking him, was there a book that he read as a child that made him want to become an author?
I choose The Seven Crystal Balls, Hergé, Tintin. My first love as a child was the Tintin books, and although I know they're not classical books because they are graphic novels, nonetheless, the stories, the characters, the world, the secret passages, the fact that the lead character is a writer, these were the first books that I loved as a child.
Unfortunately, The Seven Crystal Balls by Hergé is not available from the RNIB library, but the novelisation of Steven Spielberg's 2011 film is available in giant print and as a commercial audiobook.
There's nothing going on, Tintin complained to Snowy. I can't call myself a reporter if there isn't any news.
Snowy gave a sad woof. Tintin and Snowy were walking through the local marketplace that sold all sorts of odds and ends. As they passed one booth, Tintin spotted a model of an old-fashioned sailing ship. His eyes lit up.
Triple-masted, double decks, 50 guns. Isn't she a beauty, Snowy? I'm going to buy her. He paid the vendor and took the ship. She's called the Unicorn, he said, reading the nameplate as he held the model high to admire it. The Unicorn? A tall man with a coal-black beard pushed through the crowd. I'll give you double what you paid for her, Mr. The name's Tintin. Who are you? And why do you want my model? I am Ivan Ivanovich Sakharin, the man replied. This model once belonged to the late sea captain Sir Francis Haddock. Haddock lost his fortune when his ship, the real Unicorn, sank. He touched the Unicorn's mast and smiled. My family and the Haddocks go way back. I wish to return the model to their estate, Marlinspike Hall. So, name your price.
The Adventures of Tintin, based on the movie, read by Nick Sullivan.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
It must be Great Expectations, Charles Dickens. I came to Dickens, well, I was given Dickens at school, which of course put me off Dickens for 10 years, and came to him in my sort of mid to late 20s, and love his books with a passion. I've read them pretty much the whole canon twice or three times in my life, and one of the things about great literature is that it holds a mirror up to yourself and to your own life and to your own progress, and as you read the books in your 20s, your 40s, and then your 60s, you see different aspects of your own character. Great Expectations is quite a dark book. It's quite a bitter book. It has a very unhappy ending, and what happens to the main character, Pip, is really a sort of a decline and a fall. So it's a very sad book, but I think it's just the most magnificent piece of storytelling, and it reverberates with me because it is just a perfect book.
My father's family name being Pilip, and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip, and came to be called Pip. I give Pilip as my father's family name on the authority of his tombstone and my sister Mrs. Jo Gargery, who married the blacksmith. As I never saw my father or my mother, and never saw any likeness of either of them, for their days were long before the days of photographs, my first fancies regarding what they were like were unreasonably derived from their tombstones. The shape of the letters on my father's gave me an odd idea that he was a square, stout, dark man, with curly black hair. From the character and turn of the inscription, "Also Georgiana, wife of the above," I drew a childish conclusion that my mother was freckled and sickly. To five little stone lozenges, each about a foot and a half long, which were arranged in a neat row beside their grave, and were sacred to the memory of five little brothers of mine, who gave up trying to get a living exceedingly early in that universal struggle, I am indebted for a belief I religiously entertained, that they had all been born on their backs with their hands in their trousers pockets and had never taken them out in this state of existence.
Great Expectations, narrated by Andrew Timothy, is TB 315. It's also available in Braille and giant print.
Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the RNIB Connect radio listeners?
Why don't I go for Kolymski Heights by Lionel Davidson? Because something a little lightweight, perhaps, but this is a thriller that I read. It was recommended by Philip Pullman, not personally. His name was on the cover, and he said it's the greatest thriller ever written. And I think he's absolutely right. It is just the most deliriously entertaining, exotic adventure. I mean, it goes right back to my childhood love of quest stories and adventure stories and foreign lands and strange people, strange places, secret passages again, buried treasures, strange secrets, all these sorts of things. The story is of a Canadian Inuit who is sent on a suicide mission to the very furthest reaches of Siberia in order to penetrate a top secret laboratory. He gets there and then has to escape again. And what is so brilliant about the book, and I'm going to give nothing away, the method of transport which he uses to escape from this laboratory is so brilliantly conceived and described, I've come across nothing like it. I should warn readers, it's extremely violent. Nobody writes books as violently as Lionel Davidson. Boy, his heroes have to suffer. But it's a great, great read, and that's what I'd like to recommend.
"Hey," the man said. He seemed nonplussed. "We were waiting with a car at the airport. What are you doing here?" "I thought I'd come here," Porter said. "This isn't good. We don't make changes." "I'll remember," Porter said, and gave him his drink. "What's your name?" "Just Yoshi. On the phone, also, you just say Yoshi. You don't say all the things you said." "Okay," Porter said. "What have you brought me?" Yoshi was looking around the room. You can't stay here," he said. "There's a place waiting for you. You have to wait in that place. I've brought the material, but I can't leave it." "Just show me what you've got," Porter said. Yoshi opened his briefcase and took out a passport and a Siemens paybook. Both were South Korean, and in the name of Sung Won Chu. Porter had a look at them. They were well thumbed and greasy. His photograph was slightly different in each, but the same seaman stared out with the same piercing eyes, the same bushy moustache. His pigtail was over his shoulder in one end and up in a bun in the other. "And the ship blueprints," he said. Yoshi took a transistor radio out of his case and turned it on. "You don't need them," he said over the row. "There's better material. It's waiting for you, in the place where you have to be."
Kalinske Heights by Lionel Davidson is TB403611. And please note, it's narrated by RNIB volunteers.
Anthony Horovitz, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with the Read On listeners and for being a guest again on the show.
And it's a pleasure to see you again. Real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.